Welcome to Going Mental. This is your host, Eileen Kelly. I'm interested in the things many of us face but don't always talk about. After spending 5 months at McLean Hospital working on my mental health, I'm back. A little more insightful and with plenty of stories to share. Expanding on my usual topics of sexuality and intimacy, this season takes into account everything I learned during my stay. I'll be bringing together a wide range of guests, some beloved, some contentious, to discuss work, love, and the bizarre phenomenon that is modern life. Join me as we try to make sense of it all. On today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Brandon Unruh. He is the medical director of the Gunderson Residence, an intensive specialized residential program for women with severe personality disorders at McLean Hospital. His clinical approach is anchored in the integration of evidence-based treatments, such as dialectical behavioral therapy, mentalization-based treatment, and general psychiatric management. He has published on a variety of topics, including medical ethics and general hospital psychiatry, and his academic interests include the examination of philosophical and spiritual issues from psychiatric perspectives. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure thing. So my name is Brandon Unruh, and I'm a psychiatrist and psychotherapist at McLean Hospital, which is a freestanding psychiatric hospital located just outside of Boston in Massachusetts. And for the last 10 years since finishing my training as a psychiatrist, I've been a specialist in treating what are referred to within our field as personality disorders. And my day job is that I run two different programs that deliver treatment for personality disorders. In one of those jobs, I'm the medical director of the Gunderson Residence, which is named after John Gunderson, who was sort of the so-called parent of borderline personality disorder. And I'm also the director of an outpatient treatment clinic at McLean that employs a specific evidence-based treatment for borderline personality disorder. And I also have a small private practice in general psychiatry and psychotherapy.
So you're busy, busy.
Lots of hats. It's a good mix, though, actually. Each piece kind of adds to all the other pieces, I find.
Well, I'm very thankful that you were able to make time for us. And I know that this will be like a very informative episode, which I'm looking forward to kind of picking your brain about a lot of different things. Can you briefly tell me about McLean and the history of McLean?
Yeah, I mean, briefly, McLean Hospital, I think, has a long history as the country's kind of premier freestanding psychiatric hospital. It was founded all the way back in 1811. And the Gunderson Residence was sort of founded by two clinicians with the oversight of John Gunderson. But really, we could talk about all the other different programs that McLean has developed over the years. And it's really kind of blossomed into a place over more than 200 years of very specialized psychiatric services for particular conditions. So it's known as a place that we might use the term tertiary care, where people who live locally can come for sort of primary care, but people that are coming from all around the world actually would come when they've not been able to experience relief, despite having quite a long treatment history. So it's a place that does attract patients from around the world, clinicians from around the world, and researchers from around the world. So it has that real kind of three-part mission of delivering preeminent clinical care, as well as researching sort of the cutting edge of understanding and treatment of psychiatric disorders, and then educating the next generation of clinicians across all the different degree programs.
And there's a lot of research being done there. It's in conjunction with Harvard, or do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's the primary psychiatric teaching affiliate hospital associated with Harvard Medical School. So because we have that academic link, many people have joint appointments and are involved academically at the medical school, but have an active clinical or research practice based at McLean Hospital as well. So there's a lot of crosstalk. And I would add also with all the other sort of major Boston area hospitals like Mass General Hospital, Brigham and Women's Hospital. It's quite a big network of institutions that are all trying to partner together to kind of throw everything we've got at trying to advance psychiatric treatments.
And a little bit of just background on yourself, like how did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, I was, thinking that you might ask me that, Eileen, and it's one of those questions, it's really possible to answer in so many different ways. So I thought I'd give you maybe a few different threads, and hopefully this won't sound too self-involved,
No,
but
not at all.
I think they kind of come together into the tapestry of how I got here. So I was always somebody who was interested, I think, kind of in the intensity of the inner world of human beings and sort of in the big existential and spiritual and philosophical questions about life. I think that was really kindled for me by the books that I read as a child. And then as a teenager, as I developed more appreciation for the great literature and great books and philosophy as ways to wrestle with human experience. And then kind of became convinced that literature was offered something special because it was about wrestling with life's questions through story and narrative of lived and imagined experience, and not just abstract thought. So I came to college thinking that I might go into medicine because that would be a way to be up close and personal to the stories of other people, like wrestling with the big questions in these crucial moments. And then when I got to college, I think the thing that kind of set me on the path towards psychiatry in particular was that I took these two courses that were taught by psychiatrists that were not really about psychiatry at all. So one was a class on literature and social reflection, taught by this professor, Robert Coles. And the other was a class taught by this professor and psychiatrist, Armin Nicolai, comparing the worldviews of Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. And if you know anything about Freud, you know that he was sort of approaching human experience from a basically atheistic perspective. And C.S. Lewis was kind of a champion of a more spiritual worldview. And so I got to thinking, loving both these classes, what is it about psychiatry that allows these two professors to teach and think and grow in these other areas of human experience? And that was really the thing that kind of got me hooked, was getting to know them. And they actually both separately encouraged me to take some time off the beaten path and go work at McLean Hospital.
Okay, really?
So I did. And that's where I started before I went to medical school. And that kind of hooked me, just the it felt very humbling and kind of awe-inspiring to sort of have the sense of privilege about listening in vivo to people's lived experience. And again, it touched on all the deeper questions that I knew I wasn't going to enjoy just thinking about, like, as an armchair philosopher. So it really brought together all the things that I was interested in. And I think the final piece is that then when I came back to McLean after medical school for my residency training in psychiatry, meeting John Gunderson, learning about actually what personality disorders are, which we'll probably talk about, I realized that that would be a way for me as an MD, since most MDs usually get pulled into kind of doing those things that only MDs or primarily MDs do, like prescribing medications. I realized that kind of the world of personality disorder treatment was more about actually kind of coming to grips alongside people in these really sort of universal human moments. And I realized that people with personality disorders are struggling kind of in ways that are writ large with really universal human problems. And I thought, well, that's the work for me. I just personally wasn't so interested in kind of following algorithms of what to prescribe when. I do prescribe medications, and of course that's helpful for many people, but it was really those elements of story and getting alongside people in their kind of most dire moments and learning from them as they work through these parts of their lives, and just seeing the privilege of being able to walk alongside people. That was the stuff for me. And then the very last piece, real quickly, that I thought I'd mention is, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't add that I think the heart that I feel I've been given for working with people with these kinds of problems is partly born of having grown up with some of these dynamics, I think, in my extended family.
Okay.
And I think that I sort of would be remiss if I didn't mention, I think that's part of the influence.
So it feels very personal.
It's ended up feeling that way, yes. And I wouldn't have sort of known all that looking back at the time, but I think it's one of the threads in the threads that come together for me.
And what was that first job up at McLean?
I think we were actually called orderlies back then, almost. It's sort of an archaic term. But I think the formal term was like mental health specialist, which sounded a lot bigger than the job actually was in a way. But essentially, it was a nursing assistant.
Okay.
And, you know, getting to just do check-ins with people on the inpatient units. So I worked in the admissions center and got to see people coming right in off the street, so to speak, really in extremis, like really in crisis before they'd actually gotten a chance to have any treatment. So I kind of got a glimpse at like kind of the raw material of psychopathology and just sort of how that could wreak such devastating damage on people. And then I also worked on the short-term unit, one of the inpatient units. So I had a chance to actually follow some of those people then throughout the course of their time in the hospital and actually really see that, you know, these problems are not a death sentence. Mm-hmm. They're actually that people do get better. Treatments are possible. And there was a whole community of people who dedicated themselves to coming alongside people in these moments. I was just inspired by all of it, even though my tasks, I would say, were fairly menial, like doing checks and who's where and are people where they're supposed to be. But I did get to have some conversations I still remember now. I mean, 20 years later, I remember those some of those conversations very vividly. Those were really formative. Again, and this, what sort of stays for me is that sense of privilege about being able to be confided in around people's very personal struggles. It really felt like an honor then, and it still does now.
Have you seen a great deal of research just in recent years? You know, you've been doing this, for 20 years now? Do you feel like some of the stigma is getting lifted on mental illness?
Yeah, the stigma is a huge topic. I mean, certainly with respect to personality disorders, there's some specifics around stigma. But I think by and large, Eileen, I think in the culture, we are seeing that certain corners of mental health care are less stigmatized now. Certain diagnoses are much less stigmatized. I mean, it's much more common to see on social media, on TV, on the internet, people talking about depression and bipolar disorder and even psychotic disorders. Certainly anxiety in all of it, going by all of its different names, is something that many people, I think, it's almost strange now if people sort of aren't actually connecting with some of those words in some way in a personal level. I think that especially the generation sort of underneath me is actually quite good about being forthcoming about this in a way that we're all really hungry for. That being said, unfortunately, stigma do persist, even within the field, even among some otherwise very talented and skilled mental health professionals around certain psychiatric conditions. And I think that personality disorders, although the field is getting better about this, personality disorders have been one of those areas that is subject to still unfortunate and continuing stigma.
I think that's a perfect jumping off point. So what exactly are personality disorders?
Yeah. You know, again, this is one of those questions, gosh, we could talk about it for an hour, because they're part of the difficulty in approaching this is that there is still a lot of debate in the field about how best to diagnose and how best to understand. But we do have some consensus about some of the basics. So I'll just kind of stick to what kind of like the essentials. But I think, you know, the simplest way that I have been thinking about this over the years is that, you know, personality disorders are clusters of instabilities or challenges in key domains of personality functioning. But that doesn't really help us, because what the heck is personality functioning, right? So let's just think about what is personality, first of all. And, you know, the way that I've sort of always thought about this is that just at a conversational level, personality is like the major tool that we have psychologically for navigating the slings and arrows that life throws at us. And so if you think, well, what would that basic psychological tool have to accomplish to get us through life? And I think there are kind of several basic areas. Before we even talk about personality disorder, let's just think of like four key areas of personality functioning. So one would be just in terms of managing our behavior, behavioral regulation. So, you know, we have to manage our behavior at a basic level in order to get our basic needs met. We have to kind of present ourselves to others in a way that's, you know, remotely acceptable to the people that we would like to be known by and in relationship with. And, you know, that depends on sort of how I manage myself behaviorally at a very basic level. So that's one area of personality functioning. And then a second is the area of emotional identification and emotion regulation. So I also have to be able to recognize my own feelings and my own emotional needs and experiences. It helps to be able to put names onto what those feelings are. And it really helps to be able to actually regulate my feelings when they become too intense. And that's the realm of emotion regulation and identification. So that's a second area of personality functioning. And then a third is what happens when I realize I have to communicate my emotions and my needs to other people. And of course, how we do that depends a lot on not just what we feel, but how we think about other people and how we think about ourselves in relation to them. And that's a realm of interpersonal functioning. And then the fourth, and kind of, this isn't the final area necessarily, but kind of in my big four personally, the fourth area is identity. And everything we've said so far kind of depends in part on our essential sense of ourselves as a person in relation to others, but also just within ourselves as a person who kind of meets the world at large. You know, if I have a really low view of myself and a really high view of other people, like I suck as a person, I'm unlovable, or I'm evil, or I'm a constant failure. If that's my view of myself and my sense of others is that they're always doing better than I am, everybody else has like gotten life's instruction booklet, which I didn't get, that's going to affect my emotion regulation. That's going to affect my interpersonal functioning. And it's definitely going to affect how I behave myself as well. So it hits on all those areas: identity, behavioral regulation, emotion regulation, interpersonal regulation. And I think that's the kind of relatively, hopefully, simple way of thinking about what is personality. So then from there, it's kind of a short step to be able to say, well, personality disorder, then you could think of as instability or an above average level of challenge in those key domains of personality functioning. And to formally diagnose personality disorder, we have to say that they have to cause significant distress. So it can't be that someone else thinks that my personality is problematic. It has to actually cause me some subjective distress at some level. Though with certain personality disorders, that may be harder to actually be in touch with, the distress. And it also has to cause some impairments in functioning. So it has to, in some way, get in the way of what I think I want for myself in life, or impede my relationships, or reaching my goals in a very basic way to actually formally meet criteria for a personality disorder.
You don't have to name them all, but could you throw out like a few? And I know we're going to talk more specifically about a couple. And I know that there's clusters. There's, and I don't really know what that means, but
yeah, the clusters are sort of something we all got taught in medical school. And, you know, maybe it's just worth throwing them out because I think they can contribute a bit to some of the stigma, actually. So, that, you know, this is interesting maybe to think about. The way I was taught in medical school about the three personality disorder clusters was that there's the weird cluster, the wild cluster, and the worried cluster.
Really?
And people in medical school like mnemonics and things that start with the same letter. But the problem with that, I mean, there's lots of problems with that, unfortunately, and it's not how we think about them now. And in fact, actually, the clusters have essentially been completely deconstructed at this point. So this is an older way of thinking, but maybe it's a useful illustration about sort of how sometimes these things can be stigmatized. Because, I mean, how could it be sufficient just to say, well, these whole ways that people have developed of adapting to the challenges in their life, just to sort of call them weird, or just to sort of reduce some of the personality disorders in what used to be the cluster B category, borderline, narcissistic, just to name two examples, to just say those are the wild personality disorders. I mean, I think that, you know, you see those same kind of stigmatizing representations, unfortunately, on TV, in social media, and we can talk some more about that. But you asked for some other names. There's also avoidant personality disorder, antisocial, borderline and narcissistic, I mentioned, obsessive compulsive personality disorder as distinct from obsessive compulsive disorder itself. Schizotypal personality disorder is, we can talk more about. And then there's kind of this catch-all category of mixed or not otherwise specified personality disorder. And, you know, the reality is, Eileen, most people, I mean, certainly myself, we're all made up of a bunch of parts, right? We all have traits and aspects from lots of different kinds of personality configurations. So, you know, we can talk about that. Sometimes it's really useful for directing treatment, for there to be a clear diagnosis. But the reality is, most people that I'm working with and most people in general, you know, have traits from multiple different categories.
Yeah, isn't it? I heard once or was told once that just having one personality disorder is actually very rare. And a lot of the time they are comorbid.
Yeah. And, you know, that word comorbid or kind of co-occurring is really all it means. But, you know, that we see that both across personality disorders, so that certainly the people that come to the programs that I work in do tend to have multiple aspects of, if not full, multiple personality disorders. But what we also see is that in the older kind of DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual language of the axes, axis one and axis two, we also see a lot of co-occurring disorders from what would have been put on the old axis one, like major depressive disorder, anxiety disorders of all different forms, eating disorders, substance use disorders, impulse control disorders, trichotillomania, and so on and so forth. So this gets to kind of this interesting question about when someone has on paper, you know, comes to us and they have, like, you know, on average, I'd say between 5 to 8, you know, historical diagnoses that have been made by different clinicians along the way. And one of those is a personality disorder. You know, how do we begin to think about where you anchor treatment and what the primary goals and targets are? And I can talk more about that if you'd like.
Yeah. Could we start off with how do they develop? And I think, you know, we could be here all day going over all the different ones. So I think it would make the most sense. I mean, we could talk about generally personality disorders, but also I know the program that you work with is a lot of the time borderline personality disorder. But yeah, how do these develop usually? At what age do they develop?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, again, what one thing that's kind of interesting as a clinician working in the field that makes it challenging, but also kind of stimulating for us, is that there are lots of different ways to understand how personality related problems develop. There are competing theories about this. Some colleagues and I actually wrote a paper called The Competing Theories of Borderline Personality Disorder, and kind of putting each of them to the test according to certain criteria that we had established. And, you know, these kind of conceptualizations are very much still debated, but the take-home consensus at this point is that there are some common threads that all of the approaches see from various different vantage points. So think of, like, the old, like, parable of, like, the wise sages, you know, feeling the different parts of the elephant, right, that are sort of blind, but one feels like something long and it's a trunk, another feels like something flat and it's the ear, another feels the tail. So I think that all these different approaches kind of grasp different elements of borderline personality disorder. They just highlight different points of emphasis. But what they all agree on is that, you know, as with so many things in psychiatry and medicine in general, personality disorders are caused by a combination of biology, including genetics, and environment. So we could sort of break down each of those. I mean, we now know about borderline personality disorder specifically a lot more than we did biologically, even 10 years ago. But if you go back 20 years ago, people used to think that the cause of borderline personality disorder was bad parenting, just plain and simple, bad parenting. People used to also think in the early to mid 80s that it was trauma that always, in every case, caused borderline personality disorder. And what we now know is that trauma is neither sufficient to cause it or necessary to cause it. So whereas in our programs, we have many, many of our patients that have real trauma histories, you know, of different types. We also have people in our programs that don't describe kind of that trauma with a capital T in the forms of like sexual or physical abuse or threats to their life or their bodily integrity, but they describe, most of them, if not all, describe a core sense of a very painful kind of mismatch between their own emotional and interpersonal needs and the responsiveness of the environment. And that core subjective sense of mismatch, like I don't fit, people don't understand me, my emotions are too big in some way for the people around me, or I'm toxic because I have emotions that seem to work more intensely and switch more quickly. People start to feel like they have to keep these things secret in order to fit in. And so people kind of develop their own processes of invalidating their own emotions. And that unfortunately contributes. It's perfectly understandable. But as people kind of learn along the way, I've got to keep these parts of myself more hidden, then it can become more challenging even for people in the environment who might be really well-meaning and interested to better understand what it's like for a person on the inside. Of course, sometimes, you know, what you see are really frank kind of examples of just real severe invalidation from the environment. But a lot of times what we see on the family side, since we do a lot of work with families and parents, as well as with the people who are identified as patients coming to our programs, what we see on all sides is kind of generally people are pretty well-meaning and doing the best that they can. Certainly there are exceptions to that, but that it's that sense of mismatch that everybody kind of feels on all sides. And that's one of the things that all the treatments for BPD actually try to work through with someone. I could speak more about some of the genetics because, you know, I won't go too much into that, but
like amygdala and
yeah, right.
Prefrontal cortex. I'm like overactive amygdala.
Yeah, exactly. So do you want me to just briefly?
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot we know a lot more about the biology of BPD than we used to. A couple of interesting kind of things to know, maybe. You said one of the big findings that's the most reproducible. So when they have individuals with borderline personality disorder and they do functional MRI studies, right? You know, they see that people with BPD have heightened intensity of activation of the amygdala, as you said, which is basically kind of the emotional center of the brain. But it's a little more complicated than that, because in response to that amygdala emotional hyperreactivity, in response, the connected parts in the prefrontal cortex, this sort of where my forehead is, those are the parts of the brain that normally we all have to recruit online to deal with intense emotions, that help us take perspectives and reflect on what we're feeling and problem solve and figure out what we're actually going to do. But that part of the brain actually, in a sense, gets shut down for people with BPD in response to the hyper-emotionality that's mediated in the amygdala. So you've got kind of a double hit problem. You've got the really intense hyperactivation of the emotions, and then you've got, at the same time, a deactivation of reflective processes and the capacity to take perspectives and think and make your way through the emotional problem. So a lot of the treatments all the treatments for BPD work by sort of working on both sides of that problem. You know, some of them, like dialectical behavioral therapy, teach skills for dampening down that kind of emotional amygdala hyper response. But all the treatments work on increasing the capacity to reflect and think through what might be the other person's perspective, not just what am I thinking at the moment or feeling, and that's called mentalization. And there's a treatment that goes by that name. And one of the other treatments is called transference-focused psychotherapy. And Transference just meaning kind of the feelings that get activated in a therapeutic relationship based on prior experiences that a person has had before the treatment. And that treatment too is very much focused on helping someone reflect in the heat of the moment as these patterns are kind of getting activated with the clinician, being able to have the feeling and at the same time think with a person and maintain some connection to that person, even if they're being experienced as someone who's uncaring or unfeeling or kind of a robot or dismissive. A lot of the treatments are really hone in on that experience in the moment with the clinician. And some of them also teach a lot of skills for just managing that amygdala.
And sorry to backtrack a little bit, but can you just define what borderline personality disorder is?
Yeah, that's a good, we should probably do that, shouldn't we?
Yeah.
So, again, the simplest way to do it is actually just to talk a little bit maybe about its history. There were these earlier descriptions such as borderline syndrome that emerged in the 1950s and 60s. Some of the sort of early kind of pioneers of psychiatric thought started to notice that there was a group of people that they described as being at the border, hence borderline, at the border of the main two categories of psychiatric illness that were known at the time. And so briefly, one of the cluster of illnesses that was really known about already were called psychotic disorders. And at the time that really included bipolar disorder, people with certain kinds of major mood disorders, and also sort of real severe breaks in reality testing. But then on the other side of the spectrum, you had a lot of the work that Freud and Freud's sort of descendants were doing, which was a lot with patients that they called neurotic. So you had these kind of two levels of personality organization, the psychotic disorder level and then the neurotic disorder level. And at the neurotic level, you have people with milder to more moderate mood disorders, anxiety disorders, but also real psychological conflict, primarily in the areas of sexual functioning and aggression. So goes the old theory. But then there was this kind of emerging category of people who seemed like at times they could function much better, like people with more neurotic level problems. But then at other times they would seem to oscillate into much more severe problems in functioning and would become more severely suicidal or self-harming or just very impaired in their interpersonal and emotional life. And so this category of people kind of in the middle became known as sort of, this was the precursor to the modern view of borderline personality disorder. And then in the 70s, John Gunderson and his collaborators really, through a series of really still important empirical studies, defined the core criteria for diagnosing BPD as we know it today. And that got sort of codified in the 1980 third version of the DSM, DSM-3. And actually, kind of amazingly, those nine criteria have really not changed very much since 1980. So those nine criteria, I mean, if you want, we can go through all nine, but basically would that be helpful?
I feel like we could run through them.
Quickly, sure. So if you think about those four areas I talked about at the beginning of personality functioning, maybe this will maybe link back to that. So first of all, we think that, many of us think anyway, that at the core of BPD is the interpersonal hypersensitivity. So the symptoms in the interpersonal instability category for BPD are highly unstable relationships. And the way people usually describe those unstable relationships is with a sense of what we call idealization or devaluation. And what that means is that people with BPD generally grow up feeling like they didn't get what they needed. And that's true, actually, didn't get what they needed in a very real sense from caregivers and the environment. And so often as adults or older teenagers start to look to adult relationships with a really escalated hope that, those relationships will now be the answer. Will provide, if I could just find the right partner, if I could just find the perfect friend who will never leave, or the perfect job that will be the perfect fit, that kind of search for something ideal,
And I'll be fixed.
Then I'll be fixed.
Will be okay.
Yeah. And you can really understand that as you listen to people's stories. So that tendency to idealize, unfortunately, also vacillates with kind of the opposite tendency that when there's a disappointment, or, you know, someone is experienced as withdrawing or pulling away, or a rejection feels imminent, like a breakup or a friend kind of pieces out on you, there's that plunge to the other side, that swinging of that sense of the other person into a sense that actually they never really cared for me. They never really were there for me. You know, either they're all bad because they were sort of duping me, or I'm all bad because I fell for it. Or I'm unlovable. And that's really the truth of what's going on here. So I spent a bunch of time on that one because, you know, that interpersonal criterion of these unstable relationships, plus that tendency to idealize and devalue. And then if you add to that, the other interpersonal piece is the intolerance of aloneness as it was originally formulated. And now we talk about that as frantic efforts to avoid abandonment. So this profound sense of like aversiveness to being alone. And it's not just physically being alone in a room. It's not so much that. It's that sense of more kind of spiritual or existential aloneness in the world. But it also happens, you know, when people leave in a physical way or don't respond to my text messages, that sense of aloneness that just comes up really quickly from right below the surface. So those interpersonal criteria, many of us think are kind of at the core of understanding BPD. At least that's kind of what John Gunderson, his approach was kind of about. And that's the approach that we take at the Gunderson Residence. And then all the other 9 criteria, the emotional criteria, like emotional instability, like rapidly changing emotions, the anger discontrol that people often report, like difficulties with angry outbursts happening very easily, or the other side, like difficulties being expressive of anger, like muting anger in ways that are not very healthy for relationships, like not being able to, in a way, kind of be angry enough. You've got those emotional criteria plus the chronic emptiness, that sense of not being attached to other people or even to oneself in a way that feels soothing, that inability to kind of soothe oneself that's linked back to kind of a sense of impoverished earlier relationships earlier in life. So you have those emotional criteria plus the interpersonal criteria, plus then the behavioral criteria. And specifically in BPD, what we look for and listen for are recurring suicidal or self-harming behaviors or statements. And we could talk more about that area if you want later. That's an area that's often tends to be really easily misunderstood about BPD. Why do people do these things? But basically, they're self-regulatory strategies that make a lot of sense biologically, given what we know now, but also interpersonally and psychologically, they make a lot of sense. Of course, at the same time, they tend to cause a lot of interpersonal and emotional problems for the person who's kind of caught in that cycle of using self-harm or also other forms of self-regulatory behavior that we would consider impulsive or regulating of emotions, like eating disorder behavior, substance misuse or overuse. In the DSM, it still says promiscuity, but I don't love that term. I think to be more specific, it's more kind of sexual interactions that have a primary effect of like rapidly regulating emotion or a sense of closeness with another person to avoid feeling alone. And so then you've got these behavioral criteria. And then lastly, the identity criteria that we spoke about a little bit already, a sense of unstable sense of self in relation to the world and others. And then sometimes people with BPD really struggle with very severe kind of breaks in reality testing and can actually feel and become what we'd call paranoid or really intensely mistrustful of others or of the world, and also struggle with what we call dissociation, like severe disconnects from a sense of reality or a sense of one's own tangible body being very disconnected. So that's kind of a smattering of symptoms, but they all kind of hang together for BPD.
Thank you. No, that was a great overview. I feel so privileged to be like able to get this rundown. What do you feel like are some of, and I know when you talk about the history, like
Actually, Eileen, can I say one more? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
not cool for the guest to interrupt the host.
No, it's go for it. You're the expert here.
Can I say actually just one last thing about all those criteria? Because it sounds like these 9 criteria, like how do they hang together? And I was thinking that for people listening, if you're kind of new to this, one thing that's, I think, helpful to understand is that when you understand kind of the interpersonal core of BPD, that search for kind of that ideal other person or that ideal perfect job or that sort of mission in life, when you can understand that, you can understand how kind of all those other symptoms fall out of that in a way. So there is a kind of interpersonal coherence to all those emotional and behavioral symptoms that we can actually understand. And part of treatment for BPD is also educating people, families, and also patients themselves that come for treatment. How do you understand these like rapidly changing emotions? And that's a lot of what we do actually in these programs, especially starting out when we make the diagnosis, is just providing education and lots of materials for people to learn about, oh, this is actually a thing that other people besides me have. And although I might explain it sometimes as I have these problems because I'm a bad, horrible person, another explanation is actually you have a condition that has a name that many people actually have and is actually much more prevalent than people think in the world. So I just offer that as kind of a little bit of an attempt at there is some way to understand all of this. And and that's actually where we start with a lot of people, is helping people understand where these symptoms come from.
And do you want to say something about, like, to get the diagnosis, you don't have to meet all of those 9.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks that's helpful. You don't have to have all 9 of those criteria. And actually, most people would say that they don't exactly meet all 9 criteria. In the DSM, as it's currently sitting, in what we call Section 2, the categorical diagnostic criteria, right now the requirement is to have 5 out of 9. But I want to throw in a big caveat there, because, you know, a lot of studies have actually established very clearly that even if you strongly identify with just 1 of the BPD criteria, that's actually been shown to dramatically affect how treatments for other conditions might go. So if you're getting like standard treatment for depression, but you also identify with the interpersonal sensitivities of BPD, it's likely that actually that treatment for depression is not going to go as well as it would otherwise, unless that BPD element is also targeted in the treatment. And it may even need to be kind of placed front and center. And the same is true for anxiety disorders. A lot of anxiety disorders too, if they're just tackled as anxiety disorders, but if people on the side are kind of identifying with just a couple of those BPD criteria, the studies indicate that actually we need to kind of put, if not BPD fully as a diagnosis, we need to put those elements of BPD a little more front and center in people's treatments and help people with the anxiety from a more interpersonal perspective. And that is a finding that kind of bears out across most of the other major kinds of mental health problems. There are some exceptions to that, like bipolar 1 disorder and sometimes, you know, certain eating disorders like anorexia nervosa. When those get so severe medically that a person needs medical stabilization, you know, that wouldn't be the time to offer BPD-focused treatment. But by and large, we tend to think that there's a lot of people getting treatments for other conditions that really haven't been adequately diagnosed with at least some elements of BPD, and unfortunately are kind of missing out on treatments that we know can really work and can really improve life.
So do you see people who come to your program that are bouncing around, you know, from hospital to hospital or therapist office to therapist with, you know, okay, maybe they're treating depression or they're treating their anxiety symptoms,
yeah,
but it's not really getting to the root of what the issue is. So they're not finding much relief.
Yeah, I think, Eileen, you just described kind of the vast majority of people who come to all the programs that I've been involved with. Most people report a kind of long road to getting to the point of getting a kind of proper, accurate diagnosis of BPD, but not just of BPD, of other personality disorders too. So, you know, we could talk more about this, why this is that I think these things are not are underdiagnosed, whereas we have pretty good evidence that bipolar disorder, for example, still tends to be overly diagnosed.
Oh, really?
So not that it's not important to diagnose it if it's there. Of course, it's crucial. But oftentimes, I mentioned bipolar disorder because oftentimes when someone has borderline personality disorder, it's often misdiagnosed as bipolar disorder. And it tends to run in that direction.
Do you feel like the reason people don't get a BPD diagnosis is because there's a lot of stigma around that specific diagnosis? And Do you want to walk me through that stigma?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a deep question. And there's some research on this actually too, thank goodness. I think we could talk about two sides of this. The stigma for both patients and in some clinicians' minds. So I think some of the myths about BPD include the belief that I think I could boil it down by sort of saying the sense that the symptoms are not really symptoms, but the symptoms of BPD are misunderstood easily as like intentional behaviors, or, you know, people are just being attention seeking, or people are just malicious or kind of aggressive. Just that's just who they are. People have a death wish. That's why they're so suicidal or self-harming. So there's a lot of just reductionism around and difficulty with kind of understanding properly that these behavioral problems that get so much kind of airtime, I think, in the popular conceptualization in the media, underneath all of that, there's really understandable, relatable psychological experiences. And again, that's part of why I love working with people with personality disorders, because I see kind of writ large in their experiences the same kind of things that I and other people experience, like this search to be loved in a more unconditional way. I'd put my money down and say that's something we all kind of are hungry for at some level, if we're honest with ourselves. And that, if you understand that as being at the core of BPD, at least in terms of the person's experience of themselves, you can understand from there then why some of these behaviors become engaged in a desperate way. They're solutions to the problems that people are experiencing on the inside. So I think all the myths about BPD kind of fall out of misunderstanding that. So people say, oh, people are just attention seeking to be attention seeking, or people don't really want to get better. There's this unfortunate old term, treatment resistant, which implies that people who are in treatment are resisting getting better. And we would understand that very differently now, that in general, people are doing the best that they can to get better. But part of the ways in which there are barriers for people in terms of taking in what's being offered in a treatment setting, and those barriers interpersonally and emotionally are a big part of what has to be worked on and what people need help with kind of dismantling within themselves. So the myths, again, I think just tend to categorize people as not the kind of lovable, understandable, relatable people that the people I work with are. And that's a real disservice, I think, to the disorder at large, but to the individuals that are struggling with it. And then I think the other side is that, unfortunately, some of those stigma exist in the mind of clinicians still. And I think an additional element in a lot of clinicians' training, and I can say this as an MD, having been trained as a medical doctor, a lot of the training we get in medical school and even in psychiatry residency is, you know, kind of has this impetus on like saving a life and sort of saving people from their symptoms. And if you absorb that as a trainee in a clinical degree, and you think that your job is kind of save people from things, you're going to gravitate towards what would seem to be maybe the easier or more concrete solutions to what actually are complex, challenging problems. And so there isn't a pill for any personality disorder. And we could talk about how that unfortunately influences a lot of the dearth of research dollars that get devoted to studying BPD, because people kind of recognize there's not going to be a simple pill or a single treatment that becomes the cure for BPD. But that reality, unfortunately, I think skews a lot of clinicians away from learning adequately about personality disorders. And, you know, some of the people in my own training class, you know, well-meaning, brilliant-minded people, but just sort of lost interest or never really took interest sufficiently, I think, to kind of plunge into understanding. And I think that's tragic because, again, I think these problems are eminently understandable and relatable at the end of the day. So I think a lot of what we see is clinicians just kind of silo themselves off sometimes into what they may feel they are more proficient at. You know, like, I know how to prescribe certain medications for emotional instability. But when that emotional instability that I'm prescribing all the pills for doesn't get better with the pills, you know, some clinicians may not be thinking, well, what about all the emotional instability that we see in borderline personality disorder? And what about adjusting the treatment plan significantly to help somebody in a very different way through a kind of a therapeutic relationship? And a lot of MDs don't get very adequately trained in how to have that kind of a therapeutic relationship over time with someone. So I think it's understandable, but sometimes just more comfortable to kind of sort of sit behind our prescription pads and offer simple solutions for really, really complicated problems.
Is there like a stigma that, and I know that there has been with borderline personality specifically, but that it's untreatable, or if you give someone that diagnosis that it's like a death sentence?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that has been one of the major agreed upon advances in the professional understanding of personality disorders, and especially BPD. BPD is really the personality disorder we know the most about, and we know the most about how to treat effectively. So since the 80s, you know, when BPD was still thought about as untreatable, even by clinicians for the most part, if you go back in the literature of that time, you hear all these kind of like hopeless dispatches from clinicians that are kind of doing their best. And, you know, there were case reports of individuals getting better, but a lot of the literature from that time is actually kind of about what feels like failed treatments. And you can understand why when you think about the treatments that were being applied back then. But then along comes Marsha Linehan, who's the founder of dialectical behavioral therapy, or DBT, the first of the so-called evidence-based treatments for BPD. And in the early 90s, she starts publishing major, well-designed trials that show that actually there's a treatment that she and others developed that actually works, that can reduce suicidal behavior, self-harming behavior, that can reduce emotional instability, that can help stabilize relationships, that can promote more satisfaction and quality of life, that can help people function professionally, have better relationships with families, go on and have better, more satisfying relationships with romantic partners. So that research starts to come out in the early 90s, and then all the other evidence-based treatments kind of follow suit. So mentalization-based treatment, or MBT, then starts to publish its studies, coming from a very different theoretical perspective, but actually finding the same thing, that a well-organized treatment focused on personality disorder can make a big difference in reducing symptoms. And the other treatments, which I haven't mentioned, sort of show the same thing. So at the end of the day, what we can take home, I think then this is a big message of hopefulness for people listening. We have treatments that work significantly. They're available, but sometimes in certain regions of this country, they're really hard to find, and we do know there isn't enough to go around. So the kind of big push recently is to actually pare down these treatments so that they're less expensive, they're less like resource intensive to deliver on the part of clinics and hospitals and clinicians, and also to apply these treatments across teletherapy and video therapy. There's more and more of a push to do that, because if you're living in rural Kansas, where I have some relatives, good luck getting a good treatment for borderline personality disorder, you know, if you don't have a Wi-Fi connection. Now you might be able to actually get a good treatment for BPD. So I'll leave it at that. I could go way, way, way on about this.
No. Brings up like so many different thoughts. And like you said, it feels hopeful though, because a lot of this research seems like the 80s, the 90s were really not that long ago.
Right.
And you're saying that borderline personality has the most research compared to the other personality disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So our hope is that they start to study the other ones more.
And they are. That's the good news. Myself and some colleagues are involved in extending one of the treatments that I mentioned, mentalization-based treatment. We're extending that to treat narcissistic personality problems. TFP, which I mentioned before, transference-focused psychotherapy, has just actually a major book came out, publishing a manual on how to treat narcissistic problems using that approach. DBT has been extended for a wide variety of even non-personality disorder-related problems like eating disorders and substance use disorders, just without the personality component. So I think we're finding that these treatments that have developed for personality disorder, they're good treatments for lots of problems that people are struggling with. And I think we're going to see that the lessons from those treatments are going to be really helpful in with like the problems we're seeing in the younger generation around anxiety and interpersonal sensitivities in general.
I want to touch a little bit on, we've talked a lot about borderline, now narcissistic personality disorder, mm-hmm. just because I do feel like narcissism gets brought up mm-hmm. so much mm-hmm. in like the media these days. I see it all the time on Twitter, people saying like, my ex is narcissistic. Mm-hmm. But I feel like people don't really understand the, like there's a lot of misinformation out there. So I'm hoping you could clear some of that up. You know, what is narcissistic as a personality disorder?
Yeah, it's again a deep question, but there is a clear consensus about some of the core elements here. So first of all, you're totally right, Eileen. I mean, we have this saying among my colleagues that narcissistic personality disorder is the new borderline personality disorder, because BPD has such a history of being stigmatized and misunderstood. And now BPD actually is better understood. And again, there's so much resources people can read about that I can drop in at the end to get better educated about what BPD is. But we're still at a point where we're lacking some of that for NPD. And you know, I think there's, in addition to that, kind of the new stigma about narcissism. And I think that's coming from lots of places. One place it's coming from is when people kind of very casually, as you mentioned, throw around the term narcissistic to kind of like do an armchair diagnosis of like a romantic partner or a political figure or a celebrity. I mean, the word narcissistic, I think I saw somewhere in a study that the amount of like hits on the internet and then social media postings about narcissism has just skyrocketed in the last 5 years or so. So there's lots of reasons for this. But if we get this just limited time to kind of what is the core of narcissistic problems, you know, one way to understand it is, I think the most important thing is to say that what people see on the surface of narcissistic problems is very different than what's going on below the surface, generally speaking. So the stigma comes partly from what sometimes is called the grandiose or self-enhancing outward-facing presentation to the world. So someone who seems to be on the outside, maybe a more self-oriented or touting their achievements or kind of desperate to get a word in or kind of clawing people, pushing people to the side to kind of make more space for themselves at the table, you know, figuratively speaking. Underneath that kind of grandiose, apparently sort of self-centered, you know, outward presentation, if the person has some narcissistic difficulties, underneath that is a deep fragility of self. And one way to understand that is that there's, I'll use this analogy. This actually comes from some of the folks in the TFP treatment group. This is kind of a picture that's helpful that, you know, a person with narcissistic problems tends to have very lofty expectations for themselves and also for others. But that really lofty expectation of yourself and of the world vacillates whenever there's a sense of failing to kind of live up to those expectations. And that part of this illustration actually comes from folks here at McLean, Lois Choi Kane, and some others who've developed a general approach to managing narcissistic problems. And what we say from that perspective is that there's a live up or give up dynamic. A dynamic in which a person feels like, I'm working so hard striving to live up to my own high standards for myself. But when I feel I'm falling short and I can't live up to that, I might as well throw in the towel and just give up. And so people retreat from all kinds of investments that they were otherwise making in themselves. Retreat from a school program. People can feel paralyzed by perfectionism and feel like they're unable to turn in a term paper at the end of the semester because their own standards can be so high and they can't get it quite right enough or good enough. So better to actually kind of opt out of the marathon altogether. And that is actually kind of a self-preserving dynamic because then at least I didn't really apply myself fully. Then I kind of at least had some control over the outcome because I quit, you know, before I really gave it my full effort to see how I would do.
To me, that feels like one of the biggest misconceptions. Even when I see like narcissism online, it's like, oh, they just think so highly of themselves. They think they're better than everyone. But it's like, no, yeah. Actually, I feel like when it's a mental disorder, they're deeply insecure.
Exactly. And that deep insecurity, now I'll bring in the illustration from the other group of people. I'm giving them credit here. The DFP group. Another illustration about that insecurity is to think of it as a very deeply self-critical part of one's basic identity. And the best image I've ever heard for this is picture someone, you know, you're going through your life, you're maybe a young adult, and you're trying to plant seeds in the ground, you know, which you're not sure if they're going to grow up to be the profession that you want or the relationship that you want or the life that you want exactly. But every time you sort of try to water the seeds through your own efforts in school or in relationships or at work, every time these little saplings kind of start to grow out of the ground, there's this other part of you that is so deeply critical of one's own achievements and sort of insists they're not good enough. They're not measuring up to that ideal standard. And so it's like you're planting the seeds, and then as soon as the seeds start to grow, there's this like giant weed whacker or like a scythe that comes immediately along behind and just hacks those new little saplings off at the roots before they've even had a chance to grow into something that could flourish and feel satisfying. So I don't know if that lands with listeners, but I think that's an evocative description. Working with many people myself who have narcissistic difficulties, I think that speaks to just that really kind of sense of fragility of self-esteem and just how quickly all that sort of bluster on the outside that can get devalued by the world as just being full of oneself, that collapses very quickly.
Do you see people coming in who are like appearing very depressed, but it's actually being caused by narcissistic personality disorder?
That's a really good point, Eileen, is that depression is one of the most common presentations of narcissistic personality disorder. But it often is confusing for a lot of clinicians. If you're kind of not looking for those kind of narcissistic contributions to depression, if you just treat that kind of depression with a lot of medications or even with electroconvulsive therapy or transcranial magnetic, you know, a lot of the biological interventions, it might help a little bit short term, but you're missing what's going on psychologically for the person. And unless that core fragility of self, and with it kind of the associated clinging to perfection, if that doesn't get softened and stabilized, then you can sort of throw all the medications in the world at that problem and the person's never going to feel better. In fact, they'll probably end up feeling a lot worse because they feel like more and more of a failure. Like, I'm a failure even in treatment. And so this is unfortunately what can lead people to more of a despairing, hopeless, suicidal place in a narcissistic construction.
Do people with narcissistic personality disorder, do they seek treatment? A lot of the times, do they not? Is it underdiagnosed?
Yeah, I would say it definitely is underdiagnosed because it can be just challenging for even clinicians to grasp it and ask about these dynamics. But many people with narcissistic personality problems don't themselves seek treatment because think about what coming into an intensive psychiatric treatment involves. I mean, you've spoken so eloquently about this in prior podcasts. I mean, it involves a kind of giving up of the self, placing one's trust in another system, in another person, in a team. And for someone who's narcissistically more organized, that sort of plunge into emotional vulnerability, into kind of spending a lot of time in that space of being unsure of oneself, of expressing deeply vulnerable emotions, like what you long for, what you hope for, but haven't yet achieved, the sense of feeling like a failure in one's life, narcissism is, again, the defense against all of that sense of inferiority. So it's like you have to kind of help somebody kind of drop the very reason why they're coming into treatment in order to get into the treatment. So it is, there is a lot more treatment dropout for people with NPD. It's generally harder for those people to be retained in treatment because it's so challenging to that sense of self that insists on needing to be so strong and self-sufficient. I really admire people who are able to kind of drop their guard in those ways. I mean, would that we could all drop our guard like that, like some of the people I've seen be successful in treatment for NPD. It's really quite inspiring. So I guess that kind of brings us back to where we started.
I feel like narcissism is like one of the most grossly misunderstood mental health issues. Do you want to talk a little bit about why that is? And then maybe we could talk a little bit about the lack of empathy. Mentalization is something I feel like gets attached onto the narcissism definition a lot of the time in the media.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think there's just this human tendency when one feels done to by another person, we all have this tendency to kind of collapse our reflective thinking and just go into labeling people according to categories. So that person is just a jerk. That person is just full of themselves. And, you know, that is kind of like a meme that just gets culturally carried on. And if you think about a person who's kind of interacting that way across a lot of their relationships, it's very easy for that person just to become known by their wider social network as a jerk or full of themselves or just a total raving narcissist. And again, the tragedy of that is just that the person underneath is actually locked in a very deep private struggle that no one easily sees. So I think there's something about just the ordinary human tendency to operate in binary categories, good versus bad. That person is just a jerk, rather than, okay, that person might do some jerky things, but actually that's coming from a place of deep insecurity and feeling like a failure or feeling hurt by life in a way that they can't recover from. And that's a good example of the other thing you asked about, mentalization and empathy. I mean, so mentalization, just in a nutshell, is this like bedrock, basic psychological capacity that we all have, fortunately, to make sense of what is going on inside ourselves and inside other people. And specifically to make sense of behavior, our own behavior and of other people's behavior. So again, if I have a friend who I really feel like I need to get this person on the phone right now because only they can help me with whatever I'm struggling with, and they're not responsive, and I keep sort of pinging them again and again and again, and I'm like hammer texting or calling and they don't pick up, you know, that the natural explanation might be for all of us, like, maybe they're not the friend I thought they were. Gosh, maybe they're just full of themselves. You know, he's got that job and my job I don't feel so good about. You know, he's probably like doing bigger and better things and doesn't think much of me as a little person. So you can hear how for all of us, our ability to put ourselves in other people's shoes, to empathize with what might be going on inside them, that's part of mentalization. So when we talk about mentalization in the treatment of personality disorders, we'd say that there's a lot of empirical findings that the capacity to mentalize is more compromised in all of the personality disorders in different ways. So it's a little different in BPD, what the challenges with mentalizing are. In NPD, the challenges in mentalizing have a lot to do with kind of tethering one's sense of self to external achievements. And what one's own self-esteem is highly based on appearance or academic or professional achievements or how many likes one has in social media. That's something also you've done podcasts on, sort of how damaging that can be. But the person with NPD has more fragile capacity to understand what's going on for themselves and for others. And so they kind of overly invest their sense of self-worth in these really concrete achievements. And then when that falls apart or gets challenged by the world, again, there's that rapid collapse into hopelessness and despair.
As a clinician, is there a rise in narcissism? Just I think of like in the TikTok era and with social media, like are you seeing more and more?
Yes. The answer is yes. I think we're seeing also rises in borderline personality functioning too. But you asked about narcissism specifically. And I think there's lots of cultural commentary kind of that goes into deeper explanations of this. But one source of this, there are many, of course, but one source is that, you know, it's easy to just sort of point a finger at social media, but I think at a deeper level, just the social disconnection and that has sent all of us kind of in search of new ways of feeling connected. But then those new ways of feeling connected, as helpful as they can be, often encourage the divide between what we show the world on the outside and what's going on the inside. When we're interacting through a computer or over a video screen, there just is an inherent limitation to sort of those healthy attachment processes that we think are essential for getting through these kind of borderline and narcissistic problems. You kind of can't do it without relationship, real relationship. And there's no substitute for that. And so I think as more and more people find the best of what they
Something
can...
Please try again.
There's my phone answering the question for us. Something went wrong, it said. I think that's what I'm trying to say is that something went wrong along the way of like sort of plunging all of our relationships into the virtual world. We've in a way gone a bit too far with that. I think we're going to need to recover kind of those ordinary sources of self-esteem and relatedness that maybe we were doing a little bit better with before the advent of social media. All the treatments for BPD and NPD probably help by teaching people more skillful ways of being in relationships and managing emotions. So there's a way in which kind of all these things that we've talked about at the end of the day do come together. And what we can say is that we need to do better in developing these treatments and tweaking them, but actually we already know a lot. And I sort of want to end on that note of just hopefulness for people. And help is available, and you know, I really hope everybody out there listening can just take find some spirit in that.
Well, thank you so much. Do you want to share any places where people who want to learn a little bit more about what we talked about today could...
Great. Yes. So a couple of things, and I can share these links with you, Eileen, but you know, one great sort of clearinghouse of reliable information about not just borderline personality disorder, but other PDs as well, is the National Education Alliance for BPD. So we call it NEABPD, and that has the convenient website of just www.borderlinepersonalitydisorder.org, all one word, borderlinepersonalitydisorder.org. So that's a great place for both patients, clients, and families to get plugged into tons of resources, including some online courses that provide education. I mean, there's just like smattering of resources there for getting educated and getting plugged into treatment. So that's one great place to start with. A couple others, if there's time, McLean Hospital over the last, about the last 10 years has actually built up a really nice archive of video recorded talks by a variety of McLean's experts in personality disorder. And it's kind of a long website for this, but I think if you go to the McLean Hospital page, I think it's under the video series, Mental Health Webinars. And I can send out a link, but
yeah,
you have to
link that stuff in the
So there's probably like 25, 30 different really helpful resources on all these things that we've talked about, and like a deep dive on that. And then one last thing to highlight is there's actually a kind of grassroots BPD advocacy group that's really taken prominence in the last few years that's just like surging with interest and support for patients that's called Emotions Matter. And they're based out of New York City, but the network is really growing. And basically that, I mentioned that because they're a group that's really heavily guided by clients with lived experience and families. And there's actually lots of great self-help and peer-led recovery groups for free or for very minimal cost. And so for people who might be listening and thinking, I can't afford these fancy treatments or they're not available in my area, there are free or very, like for the cost of a few dollars, there are these recurring webinars and peer support groups that can be sufficient for some people to recover just participating in those communities online. So that's a kind of new and exciting pathway for getting help that I'd want to highlight.